Hello and welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. In this program, we visit the home of the late Peter Mathers. Peter was a writer and artist and won the Miles Franklin Award in 1967 for his novel Trap. I was very fortunate to be able to record this conversation with Peter in June 2004 at his house in Richmond on his fabled Palaco Hill, just a few months before he died after a long battle with cancer. I began by asking him about his study. Peter, as you're probably aware, my passion here now is intellectual history and the life of the mind and all that, and part of that is an interest in the idea of the study, or indeed the studio. Is it fair to say that your whole house, including the garden and possibly even parts of the street outside, would be part of your study or studio?
Probably, yeah.
Right. Peter's house was quite famous for being piled high with books in every corner, on every table and most of the chairs, and for the crowded kitchen and the little garden that produced so much compost and so much in the way of herbs. I went on to talk to Peter about his early life and how he came to start writing.
My parents were English, but they'd been in Australia for some years, and they went to England and I was born there, and then I was back here when I was less than 6 months old. So it's...
You're pretty much an Aussie from
the
start.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And most of that childhood was spent in Sydney, in and around Sydney, and...
So would you have had a state education?
State education. It was... And, of course, when the war started, a lot of teachers disappeared, and there was a fair bit of disruption, like air raid drill and shelter. You have to clean shelters and trenches and so on and so forth.
Do you remember any particular books or writers or teachers that influenced you?
A lot of reading things like Popular Science, and there's another one I think called Mechanics.
Biggles. And stuff like that.
Biggles, Ballantyne, and so on. Yep. And at school, freelance, not part of the curriculum, I got stuck into the school, had a tiny library, got stuck into the science library. I particularly remember reading a book about the chemical industry, the dye industry. And years later, I realised the intense sort of commercial competition between British chemical industry and German chemical industry. But Perkin, I think he was the English chemist who did a lot of work on dyes and so on. Particularly Mauve was his invention, I think.
Yeah, I think there's been a book written about that.
Lately, yes. I can't remember anything at my first 3 years, when the school I went to was Randwick Intermediate High School. And then the next year...
Do you like writing essays on composition?
I don't remember. Can't have been wonderful. And then I did my intermediate certificate, and then I transferred to Sydney Boys High School. But I was only there a year. And that was interesting because there was an English teacher who actually wrote and published short stories called Don Edwards. Very much a man of the Henry Lawson thing. But still,
Were you reading... Did you read a lot of short stories or novels?
Not a great deal. Only when I'd left school and I was working by day, and I was a student at night and at weekends doing this agriculture course. Okay. And then I started to devour penguins.
You did an agriculture course.
Yeah. Okay. So, it wasn't a brilliant sort of course. It was put up to sort of try to. Because the regular agricultural colleges were chock-a-block with returned soldiers and so on and so forth. And the place I went to, which was in Harris Street in Sydney, in Altamira, that was there and out in the bush. That was very... The function there was to train people to become agriculture department.
Yes. So it was a vocational.
Vocational, yeah, people.
Okay, so what, you're in your 20s by this time?
No, I'm in my late teens.
Late teens. So did you finish the course?
Yeah, I did the three years. I should have gone on and done a fourth, but I didn't. I'd had enough then. And I went off and
started work?
Yeah, well, I'd been working all right through, because I was working for Drug Houses of Australia as a lab assistant. For a while, well, the first year after school, I worked for James Hardy in their asbestos.
Okay.
Asbestos house in Sydney.
Yeah. It would be a bit of an education.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah. And they were involved in making, well, as well as building the irrigation piping and so on and so forth.
At some point, the idea for TRAP must have come up, if I'm not sort of jumping too far ahead. I'm just wondering what sort of thinking led you towards that great book, that famous book. Was it a long germination process? Did you write other stuff?
I wrote other stuff before. It was discarded. A lot of stories. I think a couple were published, two or three were published before TRAP was published. Yeah, I did think about TRAP a long time, and there were several false starts. And
well, according to the information I've got, you would have been about 35 when it was published. So there's quite a few years there, mid-60s anyway.
It was a year late coming out, because there was a fire in the printery. I remember this to have come out the previous year or something. I vaguely remember.
That sounds like an incident out of TRAP.
Yes.
Can you sort of recollect much about your state of mind as you came to write the book? Was your personal life influencing you much, or did you pretty well compartmentalise your creative life away from your family life? Some people do.
No, I don't think so. It was all mixed up, I think. Family life and writing life. I wrote the book here in the early 60s and took it away when we went.
I was interested in when you started travelling.
Late 63. And I'd started the book, I think, around about 1961 or something. And in 63 we went away, and then I altered it on the way over a ship somewhat, and it came out in, was it 65 or 66? I forget. I think it was 66.
Yeah, I think so. That's right. I think it would have been about 30.
And I was there when in London, when I got a telegram talking about.
Yeah, so you'd gone to London, and that's in fact where I first met you. I mean, I don't expect you to remember it, but I was sitting in a room. Carlo Cantieri had taken me around to visit Muriel, I think. And I was sitting there, and your name had come up, and so on, and then suddenly you bowled into the room, came in the front door and bowled into the room. And we'd been talking, a lot of the talk then was about J.P. Don Levy and the Ginger Man. And comparisons were made between you and the Ginger Man.
Now, well, I think the Ginger Man was banned here, wasn't it?
It may well have been, yeah. I can't remember.
So I wouldn't have. I know I read it over there, but TRAP had been written.
Oh, I think that might have been why we were talking, because it had been banned in Australia. Yeah. But I probably only read it. I was probably reading it.
Yeah.
Then, because I'd been able to get it. So your first daughter, I forget which is the eldest,
Sarah,
isn't she been born that time?
She was born in 65.
So you were travelling with her?
Yeah.
Was she born in London?
Or? She was born in London, yeah. And her sister was born in London, yeah. Thank you.
Something from Debussy's Children's Corner, played by Stephen McIntyre. We're in conversation with Peter Mathers, writer and artist.
At the end of Trap, Wilson Trapp warns David that he must beware of unchanneled dissent. It's a very emphatic sort of statement. I'm wondering what you meant by that. Unchanneled dissent.
I forget. I don't hardly remember. Unchanneled dissent or wide in scope, I suppose, rather than narrowly focused. Wilson is probably putting a case there for intense political activity, whereas David is a bit sort of wishy-washy. Yeah,
well, I think it's an interesting comment, possibly on my whole generation, in a way, that maybe that's what happened. There was a lot of dissent that it dissipated.
Mm. There were certain groups who kept it going, but then everyone else, I think, saw that it was what they were offering was really a dead end. I mean, the state is too strong for this sort of thing. Well, it was. I mean, maybe it's all changed now. What with the various fundamentalisms.
The Ward Papers followed in 1972, and you've published numerous short stories. There was a collection that's called A Change for the Better. Then in between all that, there's been quite a lengthy series of plays, I think eight plays.
Yeah, or a dozen or something.
You've had at least eight produced, I think, mostly at La Mama, also the Courthouse Theatre. The names I've got are Travelling Court, The Mountain King, Bats, Gregory the Third, and The Bloated Cow, which was based on
There's another one called Court.
Court, yeah, I mentioned Court.
There were two Court plays, really, just to confuse things. Mm. Court or In the Name of the Nose, that's one. And the other one was just plain Court. And then there was Urbiculture.
The Bloated Cow was based on Hussex, the good soldier, Jewish Schweik.
Yeah.
Did that Australian nationalism of the 70s influence you in any particular ways, do you think? Did you see yourself as being in an Australian tradition at all? Is this something that just doesn't matter to you? In the theatre with La Mama.
Yes. Most of the theatre stuff was done in the 80s, and that was I just enjoyed. I'd always wanted to have a go at theatre, and I tried a few times, but destroyed the stuff. It wasn't until the 80s when I got going, and yeah, there were quite a few plays. It cost you a hell of a lot of money. I mean, because you're never going, you won't get much at the box office.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in sort of what's driving you, what motivations are here. I mean, your works had some pretty high praise, and Frank Hardy for one. I can't remember now, but there's a quote in one of the books from Frank Hardy.
I remember he sort of praised it and cursed it to me. He said it was my curse.
The book's only quoted the praise bit, I'm afraid. But generally speaking, your work has been very highly regarded by many, many people, and you did win the Miles Franklin, so your reputation's pretty good. I'm just wondering if you... I mean, that's not what makes you right. And talking about cultural nationalism, you know, I'm sort of casting around looking for some sort of feeling of what is driving you. Is it fair to say your work's satirical?
Yeah, I suppose. It's comic. It's
words comical. Like biting, comic, ribald have been thrown around various...
Yeah, they get thrown around.
To me, there's sort of an epic dimension too when you're looking at something like Wart. It's a large canvas work. People saying things like, there's four or five novels in the one there with
those books, or especially Ward papers in particular. Did you have anything in particular trying to achieve?
You want to draw attention to certain things, but it's also just the plain pleasure of doing something and getting it to work and having it come out as something that you're not ashamed of. There is enormous pleasure in that. Nothing that's worth, that counts more than anything else.
Do you find you lose a sense of confidence in that sometimes?
Oh yes, yes. Yeah, that can happen.
It's a struggle to,
and
to get it back again.
Perhaps just destroy the thing you're working on, you know. Toss it out, compost it or whatever.
I sort of get a sense that maybe you see society as basically a form of theatre.
Yeah, it could be that, yeah, a lot of it is sort of horror theatre too, you know, I suppose. Well, I'm sure it is. I suppose you try to make it more... You're not going to change things much, but you can make it, perhaps make it more bearable. So therefore, I suppose, perhaps you're doing the worst possible thing by writing if you make things more bearable.
Well, taking the piss out of things is a good Australian tradition.
Yes.
Which does have that sort of benefit. Like, there's a poet at Monash, Kevin Hart, who said that everything had been critiqued and all we have left to live with is a critique. So that there's a sense of we're just sort of standing on a negative ground in a way, and the human condition sort of defaults to it's a bit sort of nihilistic, I suppose. It's one way to put it. So I'm interested in sort of trying to look at what people really believe in or stand for, other than just getting a laugh out of it all, I suppose. I don't know. One issue here that's been particularly important to me for a long time is this whole problem of European culture being transplanted into Australia and striking roots here. And I've put a lot of effort into this whole complex relationship to the landscape and indigenous culture. I've spent a lot of time reading and listening to the stories and the myths of the Australian Aborigines, trying to learn something from that. But I'm not sure what I've achieved out of it, really. I mean, have you sort of ever thought a lot about that?
Yes, you do. I think that often it's a matter of absorbing not being aware of what you're absorbing. Things I can remember in Sydney as a kid, those Aboriginal rock carvings in popular parts of Sydney. As a kid I saw them, had them pointed out to me, but not until years later did I really start to think about that sort of thing. And I wonder how many of what do they call them? Petroglyphs.
Another one related to this is, again from Trapp, the father and the son are at odds about assimilation. They want to go in different directions. Do you think of the convergence of cultures as possible between black and white in Australia?
Well, I just think there are so many examples of this. It's happened so much, I think.
You do?
Yeah.
To me, it seems like there's still a huge gulf.
The gulf is
predominant.
But then that's not surprising. I mean, after all, the Europeans have only been here a couple of hundred years. The gulf doesn't matter, really. I mean, we tend to worry about things like the gulf, I suppose, because that's an easy sort of concept. It's easy, and you don't have to, you tend not to worry about other possibilities. I don't think the Gulf matters. You always swim it or you drown in it.
Yeah, well, that's not a bad answer. But I think of Western literary history here as well, the novels and...
Yeah, there are all sorts of things are popping up all the time, and the big ones are always pushed by commercial interests. I mean, what, 5-10 years ago, the American wrote the book The End of History,
yeah,
and so on. I mean, they come up, they're sort of, they're 5 minutes of splash and maybe argument. There's never a laugh in any of them. And they're all forgotten.
Yes.
Because they're all wrong.
Yeah, that's right. Events keep confounding us.
Yeah.
Let's talk, what about art? You've turned to art, visual art. How long ago were you always interested in a bit of painting? And
always interested in looking at things and...
I remember once you referred to the brotherhood of the brush.
Yeah, well, that's not mine. That's an old jokey thing the painters used to talk about, always tongue in cheek.
But you've known a number of painters.
Yes, yes, yeah. But I only started doing anything. I started 5, making drawings and so on. So 5-10 years ago, and then making the little sculptures. Started about 5 years ago, and the sculptures are a joke. They look they're not bad looking, I must say.
Well, they certainly look amusing. Mm. Was there any particular reason you chose bread as that's sort of the main substance?
Well, that was with the early ones. That I had to abandon that and then move over to plaster. Oh, bread was available. I didn't have to buy plaster, and the armatures I could make from wood and the trees outside in the street, and wire, and bread and glue, and those early ones. And then grain weevils started eating them.
Yeah.
That was the end of the bread movement. I started resumed composting bread.
You do this for your own satisfaction, then? Basically, it's what you're saying. Like,
yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, it's an interesting break. I mean, the theatre was an interesting break. Just working with other people. Now, with the sculptures, that's solitary work, but when it comes to getting the show, the exhibition going and so on and so forth, if it's a group show, then you've got all that activity with other people and so on. Mm. It's not. I just have the feeling that launching a book nowadays is more and more like launching a new brand of socks or shoes or something or other.
Ravel's On Dean with Stephen McIntyre again at the piano.
You're listening to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, and I'm in conversation with the late Peter Mathers, writer and artist.
I mean, I don't like the spirituality, it's too loaded a word, but But I've always sort of had a thing in the back of my mind that there is some sort of transcendent reality. I don't know what it is. Do you have any belief in it, or do you just take it?
Life not really. I'm a non-believer. I suppose I'm an atheist. I'm a non-believer. And I find that non-believers have to work pretty hard at being non-believers, because believers just have faith. You know, they don't have to question. But non-believers do. So you do become very interested in what you don't believe in, i.e. religion. Because it's full of the most amazing stories and yarns and orders.
Yeah, well, that's one of...
instructions and so on and so forth.
We've had many conversations around here, I suppose, in this room, and that sort of tends to come up as sort of the antics of the church and so on.
And the history of it is fascinating. The show of mind, the birds with sort of human characteristics and so on and so forth, they are angels, because angels are obviously intermediaries between humans and the great maker up there. So of course the first angels were birds, chickens and so on and so forth. I named my first exhibition at Bridget McDonald's Gallery. All the pieces were named after the pieces of the periodic classification of the elements.
Yeah.
There's the angel Al, the angel Fir, and Zin, and so on and so forth. And they're ridiculous.
I was reading Manny Clark recently. He didn't like the secular humorists. He took the secular humanists. He thought they were too shallow, and went around grinning at everybody because they hadn't realised.
Manny Clark was full of that sort of
priestly
family, wasn't
he? Yeah. Well, he's scathing about the Anglicans as being in that sort of leaning to that sort of bag, and he winds up admiring the Catholics more. So, do you think there is, ultimately it's a struggle between believers and non-believers, and there's no room for people in between, which is sort of the way the political scene pushed things, isn't it?
Yeah, and the way the conservatives are going, I mean, conservative religionists, they're pretty... They can be pretty scary. The American ones in the bloody Mecca.
Yeah. And American Catholics are a bit scary, some of them too.
Yes.
I don't know. Is there any sort of final things you can tell us about? What sort of arts and music do you draw from? What do you like? Are there any artistic movements that attracted you with your painting? Or?
I suppose the modern work, I suppose surrealism is always
surrealism.
There's always, but also those earliest sort of quasi surrealistic things of several hundred years ago that been around a long time. Music, I like early music and baroque, modern. Some of the Americans I like. I mean, John Adams, Philip Glass.
How do you feel about American culture, Don? It's so dominant.
Yeah.
Some of us are feeling rather suffocated by it all. I mean, you actually spent some time working in America.
In the 60s.
In the 60s.
Yes.
But you've always struck me as possibly the person I've met, I think, was the least influenced by American culture.
Yes, I was in America. I just watched and listened, and I didn't like it there. I didn't like it was the time of the Vietnam War and so on, and there was drum beating, you know, all the bloody time. And they're so, that triumphalism has certainly failed them in Vietnam. And it is, I mean, there's that, Stephen Sewell has a play called The Blind Giant is Dancing, you know, and that's what that's the way it seems to me. Whether this is better or worse than the Cold War confrontation, than that.
Yeah, I mean, you seem fairly much immune to the influence of American culture to me. It's part of the context I'm talking, you know, in which I'm looking at some of those other issues before about this whole business of Australians developing their own roots in Australia. It's sort of hard to think about it, to get people to sort of put their minds to it, I think, because of they're sort of like living under a waterfall called Hollywood that just deafens everything else.
Yes. But then again, I mean, I had the same sort of stuff when I was a kid with the war with the American army here and so on and so forth. And the great luxuries that, you know, very hard to get, things like chewing gum, American chewing gum, and so on and so forth. And American, I mean, there were so many American films as well, weren't there?
It's not new, but it seems worse, but maybe that's just...
We've seen so much of it, but we're not gangs, you know, that's it. We're not.
What gives you happiness, do you think, now or in the past? Your personal relations being sources of happiness, or?
Oh yeah, that can be. Oh yeah, that's part of it. Making something good, you know. Something you're proud of.
You definitely get satisfaction out of it, your work, and it's satisfactory completion.
Yeah, if it works, and it works. Yeah, that's good. That can be a source of happiness. Yes.
How do you feel about dying?
Well, it's one of those things. The only thing I suppose one you wonder is about the presence or the absence of pain at the end, and if there's pain, then it would seem sensible to plan your departure, exit or whatever.
Is there anything you feel you'd like to do that you can't do now, or that you think you will do? I mean,
I'd like to finish several pieces of writing.
There's one thing I meant to mention about that before, which I like. You said this some years ago to me, that the manuscript that you offer it, you don't submit it.
Yeah.
Which most of us think of when we send something to a publisher, it's an act of submission.
yeah, offer it.
The writer is on top.
The publisher is just someone who makes it public, you know, putting up that stuff called money.
I like your sense of priorities there. I don't know, is there anything you feel like you want to say that I haven't asked you?
I remember when I was doing first year, I was about 18, first year agricultural chemistry. I used to read Penguin New Science and New Biology. I think they were quarterlies. I read something about insecticides, organophosphates, that were then becoming big here in farming. Commercially they were known as parathion, and then the milder version was malathion, a systemic insecticide. Reading this Penguin News, discovered that these organophosphates had been developed by R.G. Farben in the late 30s, and I think they were patented then in the late 30s. But they were used in the death camps. And I started thinking about, seriously then about the sort of the combination of big business and war. Mm. Sort of a George Bernard Shaw, sort of Major Barbara sort of attitude, I think. And then when those books, mostly American ones, came out in later in the 50s, Eisenhower himself started sort of warning America about the industrial. What was it called? The military industrial complex. Yes, but the Americans themselves were very aware of it. The growth of corporations.
Well, they poisoned themselves a fair bit.
Yes, yes. And I was fascinated by this combination, and that also linked in what I said earlier about Perkin and the German dye industry and so on, IG Farben and ICI and all the rest of them. I was fascinated by it.
In all your things here, do you have any favourite objects?
Little things, yes, that you pick up, maybe. Mm. In the bush or on a beach or somewhere, or even in the street, for some reason. Little bits of wood or shells.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I like that sort of thing too. I didn't really ask you about the bush, but you spent a bit of time in it when you came, don't you?
Yeah, yes. And when I was a kid and we went over by ship to South Australia, lived with an uncle and his family on a poverty farm, mallee that hadn't been cleared for so long. Oh, it had been cleared probably about 10 years. And once you went away from cultivation, you were in bush, you were in mallee. And then I lived on the north coast of New South Wales 40 years ago. Had a go at farming, share farming and so on, rented land and so on, but you don't do it. Exhaust yourself and you end up, unless you're very, very lucky, just a peasant farmer.
Mm.
You're too tired to do anything other than work at it.
Would you say your experience with the bush has been more work?
Yes.
Than
I've done a lot of bushwalking as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Inspiration, whatever that is. Or just as a place to work, does it do much for you?
Yes. I don't know that I've ever really finished much in the bush, in isolation. Probably because I find there are too many distractions in the bush. For a start, there's chopping firewood.
Yeah. There's always chores.
And you always like a bit of a garden.
You've got to keep all that well under control. It's true, you won't get anything done.
Yeah.
Do you have any sort of particular interest in nature or plants? Well, you're interested in plants, aren't you?
Yes.
Particular.
Yeah.
Botany.
Plants and birds, animals. I'm soon going to make an angel, and it's going to be a fossil angel.
Right.
Nice ochres, I think. Might have a little bit of colour in it.
So that's an ongoing project.
Yeah. And it knits in with a novella that I've got as well.
So you've got writing projects as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it never stops. Yeah. Never stops. It can be very slow at times, but never stops.
And any theatre things happening these days?
I've got a couple of plays, but why I feel now, I don't think I've got the energy to do anything about getting them on
production,
stage.
But
I've got them, so it's... anyway, you write them, you've always got the theatre in the head, and someone might do it sometime.
I guess we'll call it quits then, unless you feel you want to say anything.
Well, there are, but I don't know where to start.
Thank you.
I left Peter Mathers in his study late on a cold winter afternoon, wrapped in that sort of Melbourne dark grey black gloom of winter near the solstice. The mood was not unlike you find in London, where I first met Peter many years ago.
Peter Mathers gardened as naturally as he talked and told stories. In my study, on the bookshelves, I don't keep gardening books as such, but I have bush guides of various sorts, and volumes on Australian wildflowers. The Greening of Gondwana I see here by Mary White was a big book in its time. On the museum shelves, there are various dried plants. I have leaves from myrtle beeches and Podocarpus plum pines, leaves from Araucarian pines, a bunya cone. These are reminders of old Gondwana. Among them, wrapped in a plaquey bag, I have a half-composted copy of the wart papers that Peter Mathers gave me some years ago. You can hear the flakes of it. There's Australian comic writing next to the Australian soil. So that's the library and museum corner at the moment. Moving over to the project table. The subject of gardens never quite goes away. There always seem to be a few ideas about gardens kicking around on the table. There's an interesting literature on the history and philosophy of gardens, especially about the Renaissance gardens. My own garden serves as an extension of the study when conditions are right, when the motor mower is shut up and the weather is comfortable. For me, the wonderful thing about a garden is that it's where art meets nature. As I love both, of course, the interplay between the two has much fascination. My wife loves her flowers. The art in the garden may be a simple plant arrangement or the grand statuary and fountains of a Renaissance villa, or perhaps the formal perfection of a Japanese temple garden. It may tell us about the human condition or a divine order, which itself may be seen in nature, if that's your belief. There's a whole range of dialectic interplays that go on. Art and nature, we have the animate and the inanimate. We enjoy the plants growing around mossy old stones and along disappearing paths, sprinkled with birdsong. Art and nature, the static and the changing. Both art and nature can give us at once a sense of the eternal and the ever-changing, season by season, year by year. Art and nature, the wild and the domestic. I hate the contemporary fashion. The sterile, overplanned gardens with their spindly shrubs and monotonous tones. Gardens are places where small animals, birds, butterflies and insects come into the wild corners, abiding their time, rather like Peter and Palaco Hill. Art and nature, the dead and the living, beautifully encapsulated in our compost bins with all those worms of Peter's. Art and nature, the public and the private. I think a garden is public like a library at its best, where it allows the private to breathe. Gardens are not just for leisure and enjoyment. They can give food for the mind, making thought in the forms of poetry, philosophy and love can make these become visible. Their beauty awakens our very inwardness. Our garden centres on a patio partly shaded by trees. At the far end under the plum tree we have a little fountain and a small fish pond. I've decorated the fountain with old stones and shells and a few kitschy pieces of statuary. A hypothetical bandicoot twittering little stone birds. The fountain pump also drives a small cascade over a shell arrangement. I like to sit by it and read or just watch it, listening to the sound of the water. It's better than TV any day. The sound of water has its own fascination. There's another dialectic lurking here too, one of memory and forgetfulness. Gardens are where men come home to again when the long journey comes to an end and the soul craves rest. Peter Mathers, of course, will live on in his work. So with those thoughts, I will leave you with some water sounds. Music in this program included extracts from two items on Stephen McIntyre's album The Impressionists, The Gollywog's Cakewalk from Debussy's Children's Corner and Ravel's On Dean. Also Schubert's Impromptu, played by Ronald Farren Price on his album Reflections. And our two themes, The Bach Prelude in C from Ronald Farren Price and In My Study from Handel's Suite No. 5, played by Elizabeth Anderson on the Convict Harpsichordist. All of these are recorded on Move Records here in Melbourne. See the study website at www.thestudy.net.au for a link to Move Records. And so, until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.